WPHAT. You're listening to the number one health and wellness podcast, the place where health and consciousness connect perfectly healthy tone radio with your host, Darren McDuffie. And now, prepare to get fat. What's cracking, peeps? Darren McDuffie here, alias Fat Man, helping you become perfectly healthy in tone and conscious, of course. You're listening to episode 172 with Leah Penniman, entitled Farming While Black. And this episode is being brought to you by PerfectlyHealthyInTone.com. Today's episode really took me back to my roots in South Carolina as a child growing up with my grandmother and having her share her garden with me and teaching me about gardening. We also picked peas. We picked peaches. We picked just about everything in South Carolina. And you'll hear a lot of that on this episode. And you'll also hear a lot of stuff you may not have known that comes or has African roots. But before I get into telling you a little bit more about the episode, I just wanted to let you know that I took a long hiatus from posting any episodes just simply because I was suffering myself from adrenal fatigue. I know a lot of times you're thinking that nothing happens to Darren or that I'm the healthiest person in the world, but because of my job and a lot of the stress and bouncing in between time zones for some of the stuff that I do, I recognized towards the end of the summer that I was just more tired and more fatigued than usual. So I decided to take a break and really learn how to relax. And I'm still recovering. Sometimes this stuff, it comes and it goes. Some days I feel better than other days. But all in all, I know that I'm recovering and I know that I'll be well. And my intention is to get some of these episodes up for you that I have been keeping in my storage vault, because I want to make sure that you are well equipped for 2019, and then we'll get into 2020 with some more newer episodes. But again, talking about the episode Farming While Black with Leah Penniman, we get into a lot of in-depth stuff talking about African ancestry. We talk about, again, my genealogy growing up in South Carolina. We talk about a lot of things on this episode. It's really an enlightening episode about where things came from, how organic farming originated, all kinds of things in that episode, but you should enjoy it. Before I get into Leah Penniman's bio, just wanted to tell you a little bit about episode 171. If you have not listened to that episode, that was with Dr. Darren. We have the same name. I like that guy because we do have the same name, and it is entitled Solutions for Lactic Acidosis. If you haven't listened to that episode, I would encourage you to go back and listen to episode 171. A lot of tidbits in there, and Dr. Darren even discusses this, why he drinks blood. So if you don't know why this guy drinks blood and you're thinking that he might be a modern day Dracula, you need to go back and listen to episode 171. Now, let's get in to Leah Penniman's bio. Leah Penniman was raised in Massachusetts and began farming as a teenager when she worked with the Food Project in Boston. She holds an MA in Science Education and BA in Environmental Science and International Development from Clark University. She has been farming since 1996 and teaching since 2002. Coming up on episode 172 with Leah Penniman, entitled Farming While Black, here's what you're going to learn. How has the restriction from owning land affected African Americans? Many years ago, African Americans or Black people were not allowed to own land, and this has affected us to this day. Leah and I discuss exactly why that happens. Where did crop rotation and other farming techniques come from? It'll astound you to know that many of these techniques have African roots, and we discuss that in this particular episode. Why is the earth living? Leah poses that question to me because I decided to have some dialogue with her, and I answer her question on this podcast as to why is the earth living? How were seeds transported from Africa? Leah has a great, great story about ancestors, African ancestors, taking seeds from Africa and transporting them over to the States. What are some of the obstacles for people of color wanting to start farms? Leah went through a whole host of obstacles trying to start her farm, and she's reaching out and giving it back, paying it back to the community by helping others, people of color, start their own farm. Episode number 172 is ready to go. Enjoy. Leah Penniman, welcome to Perfectly Healthy and Toned Radio. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on. We are discussing your book, Farming While Black. And this brings me back to my roots because as a kid, I was always working with my grandmother. We had a garden and we always used to pick peas. We would pick peaches. We would pick collard greens. And I really wanted to have someone on the show to discuss this whole thing. And your book happened to pop up one time when I was doing a search. And great to have you on the show tonight.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk about gardening and being connected to our food. And incidentally, I also have roots in South Carolina, so it's nice to have that connection.
Yeah. So let's get into your book because I really enjoyed reading the book. And my obligatory question for everyone who comes on the show is, how did they start their journey?
That is a big question. I will say that I never imagined that I would be a farmer. You know, farming skipped a couple generations in my family. But from being a very young person, I was quite connected to the natural world, mostly out of necessity. You know, as being one of the only black families in town, in an all-white town in rural Massachusetts, let's just say the children didn't want to be friends with us. In fact, there was a lot of cruelty and bullying. And so my siblings and I spent all of our time in the forest because the forest was kind and developed a really powerful connection and belonging. So when I came of age to need to get a summer job to start saving money for college, I was looking for something related to nature. And that is how I found farming. And since that was 96, and I have not stopped. I've been totally hooked on that elegant simplicity of planting a seed, harvesting the carrot, nourishing the community, and being part of that whole cycle of contributing to something good and real and enduring. So now I'm a farmer at Soulfire Farm, and this book came out of that journey.
So let's talk about this. You said you were one of a few, you know, black families in rural Massachusetts. But in the book, it says that your father was white. So you are biracial. And one of the things I really wanted to ask you is, being biracial, I know a lot of times we kind of forget maybe a part of us, but it seems like you embrace the African part of you and this kind of propelled you on your journey. Why did you decide to embrace that part of you and get into farming?
Sure. So I'm actually multiracial. So I'm black, Native American. I'm Taino, Cherokee, Seminole, as well as French and British. Mm-hmm. And as the black community knows, you know, we as a diasporic people come in a lot of shades and a lot of backgrounds. And certainly since 400 years ago, when enslavement started in this particular country, folks of mixed heritage have very much been part of the black community, you know, initially for economic reasons imposed by those who called themselves masters, but later through Black is Beautiful and the ways that we embrace all of us. So that was really never a question. I was raised as black. I was always seen as black, mm-hmm. You know, both the good and the bad that comes with that in terms of white folks othering and stuff. And so I think one thing that really was important to me about centering blackness in the book Farming While Black is that I have read almost every farming book that I could get my hands on, and there had yet to be a positive farming book that centered black people. Mm-hmm. Everything was either about how black farmers are declining or just centered white farmers. And so it was about time that we had a book by us, for us, about the noble black agrarian tradition, which goes back a lot further than slavery and is a lot more profound than those couple hundred years of land-based oppression.
In the book, you mentioned that you being black and growing up young, and then as you got into adulthood, you kind of connotated being black or being African-American with gun activists and other things, but you never really thought that you would be an activist when it came to farming, but now you are an activist. How did that change things for you?
Yeah. So one thing that was really challenging is while I found a lot of meaning in farming, you know, I got a job at the Food Project in Boston, Massachusetts as a teenager. You know, I went on to attend all the farming conferences. I worked at many other farms across Massachusetts, and it's a very white landscape. And so I started to have that identity crisis where I felt like I was not being loyal to my people. I imagined that as black folks, we should be concerned about housing discrimination and education reform and these urban issues. And so what was I doing, like playing with, you know, collard greens and okra? I should get with the program. And it was actually, I was at this one particular conference, and there were, again, just a handful of us black and brown people. And I gathered us together, and one of the people there ended up being a lifetime mentor of mine, Mama Karen Washington, black farmer at Rise and Root Farm. And she really encouraged me that, you know, there was more to the story that I wasn't seeing, and I shouldn't give up, and I should pave the way for other black folks who are in this returning generation of agrarian practitioners. So that was very helpful.
Yeah. So going back in history, I know that you had a quote from Malcolm X in your book. And one of the things that I learned is that being African American, being black in America, there were certain things that we weren't granted an opportunity for. And one of those things was land. Do you feel because we weren't granted the opportunity to have land, or land was taken away from us in the past, that that's why so many African Americans are so disconnected from farming at this point?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of layers to our disconnection, but certainly, as you point out, we have been dispossessed of our land. For a long time, Black people weren't even allowed to own land. But then when we eventually could own land, it was by and large taken away through a combination of, you know, outright racist violence, cross burnings, house burnings, people being driven off their land. That impacted about 4,000 families. And then the remainder were often driven off because of federal discrimination. So the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, gives out loans and grants and crop allotments, and they gave them to white farmers and not to Black farmers. So over the generations, that resulted in a decline from having 14% of the farms in the nation as Black people to about 1% today. And there's a whole bunch of studies and Supreme Court case, all this stuff kind of came out of that. But I think that's only part of it. I think even more substantial part perhaps is the trauma that we carry because of that legacy of slavery and sharecropping. So even if we were to have the choice to go back to land, I think a lot of us are working through that association of the land with all types of harm, when in fact, while the land was the scene of the crime, you know, she was never the criminal. She was actually part of our sustenance. So we're working on both sides of it.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I think a lot of parents, we want to get away from that because we were the ones who were always harvesting the cotton and all of these different things. So there's such a negative connotation with that. But I always felt like when I did things with my grandmother and did things with other family members, that it always brought us together. And it seems mm-hmm. like that is this the same thing that I got from your book, that the energy there is that working on that Soulfire farm and working with the people that you work, that there's such a good energy. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fundamentally, what can be better? You know, you get together on this land, and if you own that land, especially in community, you touch the soil, you touch the earth, you get good exercise and sunshine and fresh air, you produce food that is so fresh that it's still alive when it comes into your mouth. You know, you're eating these living cells of these greens that you grew, you're cooking in community. There's really not much more to life than that. And so, you know, the trauma does get in the way sometimes of us seeing and experiencing what is the reality in the moment of what's there. And Soulfire Farm, we are on 80 acres in rural upstate New York. We're a community farm. So there's about 9 of us and then another 2,000 to 5,000 people a year who come through for our various training programs, community celebrations, and so forth. And so it's really a bustling land-based community that's connected by our common love of land and food and liberation. And it's a lot of work, but it is really joyful, as you indicated.
One of the things I got too from your book is that there are a lot of obstacles for people of color if they want to start a farm. And I know in the book, you explained that you would not be denied, so to speak. You saved up money, you did all of these things, but do you feel that because there are so many different obstacles out there for people of color, is that that's why we are probably, I believe your book mentioned that black farmers make up less than maybe 1% of the people that do the farming? Do you feel that because all those obstacles out there with land and all the things that we have to face, is that it probably deters us from becoming farmers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the land disparity alone, you know, in the last census, 98% of the rural land is owned by white people. That's actually the highest it's ever been. So whether it comes to land, credit, training, capital, like all of these things that are necessary in order to maintain a farm, there's racial disparity in terms of access. And it doesn't make me lose hope, though. You know, we're working very actively on challenging the federal government where that's necessary, as well as setting up our own organizations. You know, like we have a land trust in the Northeast called the Northeast Farmers of Colored Land Trust that's receiving land donations and redistributed them back to Black and Indigenous farmers and growers. So there's a lot of things we can do to address it. And I think the good news is that there is a clamor right now. I mean, there are just so many people. We have a waiting list of 3 years to get into our farm training program because there are so many people that really want to get back close to the land, growing their own food and providing healthy, sustaining nourishment for their community. So where there's a will, there's a way.
Well, what were some of the, I know that probably money was something that you faced, but what were some of the other obstacles that you faced while you were trying to get your farm off the ground?
Yeah, well, money was a huge one because I learned very quickly that a traditional bank does not want to fund a farm and they don't want to fund any kind of alternative construction or funky things with community ownership. So that became very difficult, and we had to end up pulling friends together and building our own community lending circle in order to get funding for that. So that was a big deal. I think another major issue for us was just our own relationships and our own grit. You know, it's an indescribable amount of work. You know, when you're rural, you have to dig your own well. You got to plow your own driveway. You got to haul your own trash, build your own house, chop your own wood. So there's some stressors that are really different from urban life. And there's many times when we felt like we didn't have it in us, or those stressors would impact our relationships with the other people on the farm. And it took us, you know, both the work of learning some good conflict transformation skills, as well as figuring out how to just gain the endurance that it takes to do this kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to start working with people and really kind of get them to bond and do the things that you would like them to do to be as a cohesive unit. Mm-hmm. A lot of what was in your book kind of struck me as I was very proud, because a lot of the things that I didn't know about farming, you answered in the book. And there were so many roots that were African roots about organic farming and all these different things, as far as we don't know these things. And because we only see a different ethnicity saying that, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what we never get the development part of anything or how anything started. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about the things that were in the book, as far as I know organic farming was one of them that had African roots, and there were some other things that had African roots as well. I believe it was crop rotation and all these things that people have followed farming. They know that these terms are mentioned all the time, but there's never any mention to where these terms originated.
Right. Isn't that wild? And I think that probably the most important thing for me on this journey was to uncover that history, because I had always, as I mentioned, thought I was biting, you know, some European thing or white people thing, and wasn't embracing or being loyal to my folks. And so when I learned that composting with worms, which we call vermicomposting, started in Egypt with Cleopatra, and cover cropping, which is when you plant like a legume in order to strengthen the soil, that comes from George Washington Carver, black farmer in Alabama, and the CSA, community supported agriculture, and pick your own, you know, also comes from a black farmer, Booker T. Watley, and so on. So many examples. There's dozens in the book. That was a great source of pride and also a great source of relief for me, because it wasn't like I'm trying to start something new being a black farmer who has a sustainable orientation. I was building on the legacy that my ancestors laid out for me. And I did some deep research, and I could not find one sustainable agriculture technique that did not have a connection to the innovation of black farmers, which was profound finding.
That made me really proud too, because a lot of times you just don't know where things are coming from. And like you said, it's a sense of pride when you know that certain things come from African roots, and you being having that African ancestry, that you can connect with that. Speaking of which, you made some trips to Africa, if I'm not mistaken.
I did. You know, I giggle a little bit at my younger self, because I think so many Black Americans do that roots trip thing where we want to find out who we are and where we're from, and we end up finding out something really different maybe than what we expected. So yes, I spent about 6 months in Ghana, West Africa, and I've been back a few times since that original longer trip, and was really fortunate to be embraced by some elders there who are called the Queen Mothers, or Manye, and they are spiritual leaders in the community who also do a lot of civic work. So they take care of the orphans and run businesses and solve conflicts and so forth. But they taught me a lot about a lot of things, including farming and including the importance of having a spiritual aspect to the way that we interact with the earth.
Yeah, speaking of spiritual, and I think for me, as I've gotten a little bit older in the world, I think that there's a spiritual part and then there's a religious part. And you talk in your book about performing certain rituals over the land. And it wasn't until maybe 2 to 3 years ago that I had this kind of awakening, that I started believing that the land is not just something that's out there. The land is something that actually lives, and the earth is actually living. But you perform these rituals. Why do you perform these rituals when you're planning and doing all these other things?
Well, now I'm curious. I want to hear about your revelation that the earth is living. So maybe we'll get to that later. But yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, I'll tell you a quick story. So when I was in Ghana, one of the things the Queen Mothers did was they liked to call me in and ask me questions about life in the United States. And a little bit in jest because they thought we're sort of funny people with our different customs. But one of these times they asked me, is it true that in the United States, the farmer will put a seed in the ground and they will not pray, they will not dance, they will not sing, they will not pour any libation or sing any gratitude to the earth and then expect the seed to grow? And I said, well, yeah, you know, that's very commonplace. And they explained that that is why we're all sick. We're all sick because we treat the earth as a material, physical being and not as this living entity that is deserving of respect and reciprocity and consent. So they said, you know, you can't just take and take from the earth because then you're also, your own soul is depleted, you know. And so they taught me some basic rituals. We have put a little offerings on the ground. We say thank you. We sing some songs. We have a harvest ritual and so forth as ways of acknowledging the amazing gifts that we get from the Mother Earth and from all of creation.
Yeah. And to answer your question, I just think that with everything that's going on today with the pollution and different chemicals and all these things in our food, I just feel like the earth has to be living. The earth has to be at least a bit mad at humankind because of we have no connection to our food. Again, we have all this contamination that's going on of the environment. And I think that the earth is, it's a living earth and it's mad at us. And we need to take a little bit more care of what we have here before we actually lose it. But speaking of, you mentioned seeds, and I remember watching one of your YouTube videos and you said something about how the seeds were transported over here from Africa. And it was weird to me, Leah, that it seems like most of the stuff that we grow here today is not native to America at all. But talk about that whole thing about your ancestors and the seeds and how they were transported over here to Africa. I think it's an amazing story that people need to hear.
Oh, sure. I mean, this story has just become my life breath. Because it gives me so much hope. So the story goes that my grandma's grandma's grandma, Susie Boyd, and other women in the community, as they witnessed their brothers and daughters and cousins and aunties get snatched up by slave catchers and taken forced into these ships, one of the decisions that they made facing that uncertain future was to gather up the okra, cowpea, millet, sorghum, black rice, egusi, Molokia, you know, all of these sacred seeds that they had been saving for generations that are native to the motherland, and they braided them into their hair. They hid them amongst their corn rows because they knew that whatever was going to happen, they would need the seed because they believed that there would be a future and they believed that they would have descendants and that this was the precious heritage that would be offered. So it really encourages me, you know, if they didn't give up on us and our existence, then who are we to then give up on our descendants, even in the face of really difficult times?
What are some of those things that aren't native to America? I think one of them was, if I'm not mistaken, watermelon was one of them that's not native to America that was brought over. But what were some of the other crops that aren't native that was brought over?
And in this moment, too, I have to pause and take a moment to shout out our Turtle Island indigenous people, because most of the crops that we do eat and grow are from here and many times were appropriated or stolen from native folks. So our corn and beans and squash and a lot of our tubers, you know, do come from here. And so it's not to say that that doesn't matter. But as far as the African crops that many of us might not think of as coming from Africa, certainly okra and rice. A lot of people think that rice is Asian, but rice farming in the United States started from Mende farmers who were expert rice growers in West Africa and brought that technology over to the Carolinas, making trillions of dollars for the empire. Coffee, sesame, melon, as you mentioned, eggplant. So there's many, many crops that we enjoy on a regular basis that are from the continent.
Yeah, that's so weird because I know in South Carolina, particularly I think you had mentioned that you had roots in South Carolina, but I know down around the Charleston area is where we have the Geechee or Gullah people, and they are big, you know, rice eaters. And the story goes that those people came over here from the islands. And they start, you know, they still have that culture going on there. But I know I'm from South Carolina and we ate rice with practically everything. So yep. We were rice eaters, and every Sunday, my mom had something. We had collard greens, we had mustard greens. And you mentioned all of these crops in the book. And it kind of brought me back to having those Sunday dinners with my mom. And I never, being a kid, you never kind of realize that these things have been handed down from generation to generation. And you're just sitting there just eating it. And you're like, you never give a thought of where it actually came from or how it is so intertwined within our people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't it fascinating the way that, I mean, mm-hmm. culture is the air we breathe and the water we swim in. And I think it's when we lose it that we notice it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm going back to just your mission. What is the Soul Fire Farms mission? What is your end thing that you're doing? Because I know in your book, you had some really good results of how you're helping the community.
Yeah, well, we have a pretty ambitious mission that we don't imagine we'll accomplish in our lifetime, but it is to end racism in the food system. And our small contribution to that, we have three basic things we do. One is we grow a whole lot of food, you know, Afro-Indigenous food using sustainable methods, and we do doorstep deliveries to those who need it in the community at affordable prices. So that's number one. And then number two is the education programs. You know, our mission is really to support this next returning generation of Black and Brown farmers to make their way on land. And so we offer training and support in getting land and jobs and scholarships and all the things you need. And then the third is to try to change policy, because unless we have fair laws and fair systems, it's going to be really tough to make it as farmers and really tough to access that food. So we do a bit of, you know, organizing and rabble rousing and speaking and talking about these issues as well.
You mentioned in your book, I learned about this a long time ago, and the terminology used at that point in time was food deserts, where people couldn't mm-hmm. get really good food, produce, and the things that they need to be healthy. But your terminology was food apartheid. Talk a little bit about that and your role in helping with that situation.
Definitely. Well, I need to shout out again my mentor, Karen Washington, for teaching me that term of food apartheid, because the government says food desert to refer to a zip code or a census tract where there aren't enough grocery stores and people are poor. But a desert implies a natural biome, this phenomena that's inevitable, whereas apartheid is a human-created system of segregation, you know, that relegates certain people to food opulence and others to food scarcity. And there is nothing natural about the system we have right now where your zip code, because of a history of redlining and housing discrimination, zoning that excludes Black and Brown people, it's very racially divided. You know, if you're white, you're four times as likely to have a supermarket in your hood than if you're Black. And that has all kinds of implications as far as hunger and diabetes, heart disease, obesity, all these diet related issues, because you just can't get the good food at an affordable price in your neighborhood.
One of the things, and I wanted to get your feedback on this, because a lot of times what I hear is that even if you give people the opportunity to get better food, they're going to go over to the processed foods and the things that aren't good for them. But what has been your response? You said that you make the food affordable so anybody can afford it. What has been the response? Are you seeing that these people, Black Latino people who have the opportunity to get your food, or do they want to get it, or do they want to go towards the processed foods?
We have found by and large that people absolutely want the food. And it's not to say that there isn't an issue with our palates being colonized. You know, that processed food, there's a science to it. It feeds on your addiction. It feeds on the serotonin levels in your brain, and it acts like crack. So there is a way that we still have to combat that. But we find that by and large, people do want the food. And we've had now thousands of youth come through, and youth are notoriously picky. And every single person who has come has enjoyed those vegetarian burritos. They've enjoyed the salads. They've enjoyed it. And part of it is because they got to participate. You know, they pick the food, or they know who picked the food, and it changes that relationship into something that is personal and meaningful and sacred. And I'll mention one other thing too, is in some ways our programs end up being a palate cleanse for people. So most of our programs, people will come and live with us for a week just because we're pretty remote. It's hard to just commute back and forth. And so during that time, we're cooking all meals from the food that's grown on the land, and we're eating together. It's, you know, mostly vegetarian. We do some healthy, you know, pasture raised meat and so forth. And people find by the end of the week that there's been a shift in terms of what they crave. So we try to provide that support and opportunity, you know, for folks to, you know, retrain their palate towards these life-giving foods.
How do you make the food affordable? Because I know a lot of times, you have to obviously support yourself, And then you have to get all this food out. But how do you make the food affordable for those people that might not be able to, quote unquote, afford it?
Yeah. I mean, it's really tricky, you know, because as you noted, bad food is more affordable right now. And that's because it's subsidized by the government. So we do have to still address that at a systems level. But the way that we're dealing with it is we use what's called a sliding scale model. So people subscribe to the program to get the food deliveries. And then if they have less wealth and less money, they pay less. And if they have more, they pay more. So we have about half of our members who are middle income to higher income who pay a little more than market. And then the other half who pay much less for their food. And so in that way, the community comes together to make sure that everybody has what they need to eat.
Mm-hmm. As far as planting food and doing all this stuff, as a kid, I don't know. I kind of took all of this stuff for granted. And I know that you get really intricate in the book about soil and how to do the soil. But soil isn't just soil. You have to, there's certain things that you have to look for. And I remember in the book you said that there was a point where you had bought some land and you guys were out there trying to farm it and you realized that you had some lead in it. But talk about soil and the quality of soil and some of the things you went through when you were starting your farm.
Mm. Yeah, soil is so sacred to me. You know, it really is the source of all life. And I think about that first generation after the colonizers got here and they took the soil and turned it up using a plow. And half of the life in the soil, and we measure that through organic matter, half of the life went away in one generation. And so a lot of what we're doing is restoring that life. And we measure it, as I mentioned, as organic matter. So after the colonizers came, they reduced the soil organic matter. It's like 2 or 3%. And now we've gotten our soils back up to 10 to 12, which is where they should be. And that is the ticket to so many things, because when you put the organic matter back in the soil, first, it slows down climate change because the carbon is not in the air anymore. You know, second, it binds up a lot of the toxins that are in the soil so that they can't get into your body, right? And it brings all that life back into the soil for healthy, nutrient-dense foods instead of these foods that taste empty and are empty of nutrients. And so that's been the primary work, whether we're in urban or rural soils, is how do we get that organic matter back? And there are special plants you can use, like the Senna geranium, that specifically pull out toxic metals. And that's something we had to do when in some urban soils where my own daughter was lead poisoned from the land. We had to do this more intensive mining of these heavy metals out of the soil to make it safe. But the soil can be healed, and it is healed using these methods that our ancestors have taught us.
And your food is all organic, I'm going to assume, right?
It is. We're not USDA certified organic. We use a group called Certified Naturally Grown, which is another certifying agency that actually has stricter standards. So that's what we certify with.
Yeah, I've had some people on here talk about organic farming. It's just that from what I gather from them is it costs so much to have everything be certified organic through the United States. And especially when you're a farmer like yourself, that money could be kind of going on elsewhere. So it's like, the government is like trying to either, you know, take money out of your pocket for, you know, for the greater good. That's crazy to me.
My friend actually made a good point. She said, what if instead of having to be certified organic, you had to be certified in order to use all these harmful chemicals that are trashing the water and the air? And that was the bureaucracy that you had to go through. And I said, that is a really good point. They make you jump through hoops to do the right thing. You have to jump through any hoops to, you know, do the wrong thing. So you know, it gave me some pause.
Yeah. What's your feeling on that? I wanted to ask you about that. And that's a great segue because talking about farming, most of the talk within the last 4 to 5 years, or maybe even longer than that, has been about GMO crops. What is your feeling about those?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really going down the wrong road because right now we're not investing much resource at all into traditional plant breeding, which is how we got the great diversity of crops we have. And it's a way that really works with nature. So we've been divesting from that healthy way of developing new varieties, which is a very important process, right? Ancestral indigenous practice, and going into GMOs, which have really unforeseen consequences. You look at the impact of BT on the native pollinator population and, you know, super weeds generating and all of this. And so I have a lot of concerns about thinking about technology in this really narrow way when it comes to agriculture and believing that we can solve our problems by pitting a war against nature in that way.
Yeah. And in your book, you also talk about seeds and how certain people were the seed keepers in the community. And I remember reading many years ago about Monsanto. Everybody knows who Monsanto is. If you don't, you probably need to research it. But Monsanto was buying up all these seed patents. But talk about the importance of seeds and why this might be detrimental in the long run.
Oh, absolutely. This whole idea that you can own life or patent life is really dangerous. The commodification of what is our collective commons. You know, I was just on a phone call earlier this week with another elder mentor of mine named Ira Wallace, who is the founder of Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, as well as the Acorn Community in Virginia, older Black woman. And she was talking about how she wants her legacy after she leaves this earth to be that we as Black farmers who grow seed get together and save our ancient varieties, that we pass on the stories and that we collaborate with each other. So a bunch of us were on this call around the country trying to figure out the best way to do that. And to me, that the seed is not just the genetic material that results in this food. It's also how we pass on the stories of who we are and a deeper level. And so I think with the idea of patenting life, we sort of cut off that connection between people and their own heritage.
Has there been any pressure on your farm and other farms that to get away from being organic and go towards GMO crops and anything like that?
No, I would not say that we're pressured to do that. I think it more comes in the form of incentives and disincentives. And it's all these subtle things. You know, when you go ahead and fill out the census as a farm, the way the form is set up doesn't really work if you're a small-scale, diversified grower. They'll say, how many acres of corn? You're like, well, our corn is mixed with our beans and our squash, because that's how they can't handle that, you know? And so that impacts the way that you show up in the census and, in turn, the way that resources are allocated. So there's all of this bias kind of built in to the system that makes it just a little bit harder for you at every turn. But no one has come to us and said, you know, take the seed. In Haiti is another story, though, where we work, because Monsanto literally is banging down the doors and trying to push this genetically modified seed on the farmers.
Here's a question for you that I've been really wanting to ask. When do you know when to harvest for the best flavor? Because there's a really, really well-known supermarket. It's an organic supermarket, and I've bought fruit from them on several occasions, and it's just like the fruit does not have any taste to it. And So when do you know when to harvest for the best flavor and for the best color of the fruit?
I like that you're not mentioning the supermarket. I see you. So here's the thing. You harvest it at peak ripeness, and this is a huge advantage to living where you grow your food, or if you have a garden. Because I can harvest a tomato at peak ripeness and put it right on my plate and eat it, and it will be full of flavor and juice and texture and all the things. If you need to ship your food, you have to harvest it before it's ripe. And the longer the journey, the less ripe you have to pick it. So even when we pick tomatoes to ship the next day to our customers, we pick them when they're not quite ripe. They're just a touch before. So they still have very good flavor, but it's not perfect. Now, if you're trying to get a tomato from Chile all the way up to New York or Chicago, you have to pick that weeks before ripeness. And that's why you're not tasting any flavor, because the plant hasn't finished essentially cooking the food for you and preparing it for you. And that's one of the problems with having a food system that is so delocalized, that we're getting, you know, we get tomatoes any time of year that we want, but they're not really tomatoes.
Yeah. And I've always wondered about that, because I didn't want to mention, but if you listen to me, you know exactly the supermarket I'm talking about. And I've had that experience with several different supermarkets where you, especially during the summertime, where you're like, I'm a big nectarine eater. I love nectarines and I love oranges and things of that nature. But I've had that experience of really biting into an orange and it has no flavor, or biting into a nectarine and it has no flavor. And even peaches. And coming from South Carolina, peaches were one of our really big crops. And for me to taste a peach without any taste to it, it's just like it kills the whole experience for me. Mm-hmm. So I always wondered why that was. And now you're explaining that, you know, just because of the way that everything is grown somewhere else and shipped, that they have to pretty much ship it before it's actually ripe.
That's right.
Yeah. So what are some of the challenges when you are planting food, some things that you run into when doing different things. Are there certain crops that are easier to plant than others, certain crops that you don't have to watch as much as other crops?
Oh, sure. You know, something I love about farming, this might sound a little weird, but you get to know the land the way you would know a lover's body. You know, it's just like a very intimate and particular relationship. So every land is going to have things that grow well, things that don't, a special way it needs to be treated, talked to, you know, and so we know on our land, you know, because it's heavy clay, that some of the roots are going to have more challenge. But the greens are going to grow really well. We know that the tomatoes need a high tunnel or they'll split, but that's not going to be true on everyone's land. So one of the blessings of being a farmer or a grower is this opportunity to know and love a place very deeply and very intimately. I would say the universal things that are very easy to grow, include garlic and salad greens, which can get you pretty far. So if people just have a tiny plot of land, I always recommend that they start with those two things.
Is there any instance where you have totally messed up planting? I know I've experienced this when I was kid and I had a garden and I like planted something and I came back and everything was dead. What was your experience with that?
Oh, we mess up all the time. But I think one of the most salient ones, just because there was a huge economic impact, was that we had planted a whole orchard of trees and we had neglected to put up a deer fence around each of those trees. And we came back after a couple of weeks and the deer had literally killed the trees because they had eaten, you know, all of the foliage. So that was an expensive and sad lesson to learn, that, you know, it's not putting the seed in the ground is kind of the easy part. It's all the things before and after. It's all the soil building you got to do and make sure you have your drainage and staking and fencing and all of that. The seed is the dessert part.
Yeah. You talked about having just a small plot of land. Is that advantageous? Because I know sometimes people think that they have to do everything on a large scale. And I remember reading an article several years ago. I don't know if you're familiar with Ron Finkel. He's the guy who's in, he's in South Central LA and he has.
Oh, Ron Finley.
Finley. Yeah. Ron Finley. So is it advantageous for someone like myself who's just a normal citizen? I don't have a ton of land. I have a plot back in the back that I can maybe plant a few tomatoes and plant a few collard greens or whatever it is just for myself. Is that advantageous for people?
Oh, it's so advantageous. Because here's the thing. People through all time across all cultures have had what they call jardin la cour in Haitian Creole, which means a house garden. Mm-hmm. It's just part of who we are. And it doesn't have to be a lot of space. A few herbs, a few salad greens, one tomato plant. That's going to provide this nutrient dense, fresh, delicious food that's incomparable in taste to anything you can get at the supermarket. And you don't need much space. So I really believe that everybody who's able should have at least one garden bed. Like that would do so much for humanity, right? If we could do that.
Yeah. Is there any instances where people have kind of joined together, not for something as big as your SoFi farm, but just maybe two or three community members join together and say, hey, you know what? We have this bit of land and hey, I'm going to work it this day or you work it that day. And then we take what we have, the harvest, and then we divide it up amongst ourselves.
Oh, for sure. You know, the urban community gardens movement was catalyzed very much by Black and Brown farmers in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And a lot of farms are set up that way. They don't all divide up into plots. A lot of them have a big common space and they work together and share the harvest. You know, I was just recently in Chicago at Huerta Semilla, and they organized that way, as well as some of the other gardens. So it was really neat to see elders and young folks coming together to collaborate in terms of feeding themselves at each other.
So you not only do plants, you also raise animals as well. And you're vegan.
So, I am not a vegan.
No, oh, you're not a vegan. I thought your book mentioned that you were vegan.
No. I thought a lot of the food that we serve is vegan. So we do, we do raise animals on pasture, poultry predominantly. We raise chickens for meat and for eggs. And the part of processing a chicken from the field, you know, to the freezer is integral to many of our training programs. And most of the people are interested in learning that skill and having that experience and really thinking about what is an honorable and ethical way to engage with meat. And so, you know, something that I've learned from my ancestral tradition is that, you know, animals certainly are part of the agricultural ecosystem. They put down manure, they eat pests, you know, they're part of it, but they are never supposed to be the main part of a diet. And so we've gotten really out of whack in the Western diet in terms of the quantity of meat that's eaten. That meat should be a special occasion thing or a spice. You know, you throw a few bones or a turkey neck in your stew to spice it up, but it's not something that you're having these slabs of flesh all the time. And so that's the way that we engage with meat here, is that the animals really contribute a lot. We wouldn't have the fertility that we have here without them. And we have, during our week-long program, we'll have one meal where we serve sancocho, which is a Dominican stew that we put chicken in. But other than that, we do serve vegan and vegetarian meals and encourage people to think about plants as the main part of their diet.
I've never slaughtered a chicken. I've only eaten chicken.
Well, you better come over. I'll teach you how to do it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because you go into a real in-depth description on how, you know, the chickens are slaughtered. But my question to you is that you've done this before. What was your experience the first time you did this? Was there any type of spiritual antagonism going on with you? Because I know to take another life, I don't know if I could do it. I mean, I like chicken. I like meat, but I don't know if I could slaughter
people
chicken.
Who are meat eaters who, you said, hold on. I said, I joke with people who are meat eaters who won't kill a chicken. I'm like, so you're basically paying someone to do it for you. So does that make you feel better though?
right. But it just seems like it's the process. But take us through the process of what has to be done. Sure. Because I thought it was very interesting. And for someone like me, I had no idea that this was done. And I don't think a lot of people, even though you have a farm, like we said, people are disconnected and know where their food will come. I think a lot of people are also disconnected to where meat comes from. But I also thought that what you did was more humane than just a regular slaughterhouse. So that's why I wanted you to describe it.
Sure. And just to say, you know, you asked about the ethical challenge. And I think that it's not to be taken lightly to take the life of an animal. I happen to believe that the life of plants and soil organisms is also sacred. And so for me, it's not so much an ethical conundrum around taking life, but it's about how do we honor all the lives? So I'm going to honor a tree before I cut it down if I need to cut it down, and honor the soil before I dig it up if that's what I have to do. So it's about how do we engage. And I think we learn a lot from our indigenous comrades in that, you know, the Haudenosaunee, whose land we are very near to here in upstate New York, have this prayer of Thanksgiving they say before every gathering, and it thanks the animals for giving their lives and the plants for giving their lives and all of this. And that tends to align with my cosmology. But anyway, your question is the process. So we raise our animals on pasture, which means that they get to live a life outside, you know, eating bugs and chasing each other around and scratching up the grass and all of that. And then when they reach 11 to 13 weeks, we use a breed that grows slower because it's more humane than the fast growing breeds. So they're 11 to 13 weeks, they're full size. And then we use a very sharp knife and a killing cone to, you know, cut an artery so that they die quickly. And then from there, you loosen the feathers, you know, you got to take out all the organs, put them in the freezer, certain kind of cleaning and packing process. And the whole thing, it takes us, you know, half a day to do maybe 50 birds. And then we provide those also on a sliding scale to our community to make sure that there's good, healthy meat without any chemicals, bad chemicals in it, you know, going out to people who need it.
Are you using the same chickens for eggs as you use for meat, or is it totally separate?
They're separate. So, you know, certainly all chickens can lay eggs, but there's different varieties that have been bred over the generations that specialize. And so an egg laying bird matures in 6 months, you know, so it takes a lot longer and is specialized to lay eggs. So they have a smaller body and a feed to egg conversion ratio that's different. So they are separate, but you can certainly eat your egg laying hens after they stop laying eggs. And, but what you get then is a kind of scrawny, what we call a stew chicken. And your grandmother probably knows what a stew chicken is, but a lot of people these days aren't used to that. They're not used to taking a whole chicken and putting it in a pot all day long for it to get tender enough to eat. But we have been reviving that practice.
Yeah, I've had that stew chicken before a long time ago. One question I did have to ask you, and this has been on my mind, but we have a farm here. I live in Davie, Florida, and we have a farm that we can go to and get eggs They raise the eggs. They do the chicken. One of the things I've noticed about a fresh chicken is that it's very hard. I don't know why, but I cooked a fresh chicken before that was just slaughtered. And one of the things, like I said, I noticed that it's very hard. It's not like a chicken that you would come, like, let's say I go to the grocery store and I buy that chicken. Why is that?
That's funny. Well, I mean, I can't say how that farmer raised their chicken, but if mm-hmm. they are raised on pasture and they're not confined, mm-hmm. they get more exercise. And so that means their muscles are more developed. You know, when you mm-hmm. buy a chicken in the store, it's probably lived in a cage its whole life and it's never been allowed to walk or move. So it's really just like a meat factory. It's not an animal in the sense of getting to live like an animal's life. And so, you know, with a chicken, if it's a little tougher, you need to cook it a bit longer. So you can either throw in a crock pot or you can, you know, I bake our chickens in the oven for about an hour to an hour and 15 on low with a lot of good juices in there and they get nice and tender. So you might just need a slightly revised cooking strategy for your healthy meat.
Yeah, I remember the first time I did one, I was talking to my girlfriend. I was like, why is this so hard? And she's like, I don't know why. It doesn't taste. The taste was good, but it just wasn't the texture that we were used to at that time from, you know, just getting it from the grocery store. So it was really.
Makes sense. Yeah. I mean, the farmer could have been doing something else too. Our chickens aren't that tough because we do keep them. They're in a run that moves every day, so they get fresh grass, but the run is pretty small. So they're not, you know, getting so much exercise that their muscles get really tough. So the farmer might have just been letting the chickens run miles a day, and then they would be quite tough.
Yeah. Going into vegetables, we talked about crops, but I want to get back to vegetables here. The challenge I found with a lot of organic vegetables is that they go bad really fast, especially if you don't eat them. What are some of the ways you discuss in the book, you know, some ways to preserve your vegetables so that, you know, you can keep them at a longer time?
Sure. Well, one of the nice things is when you do harvest them super fresh, you know, they keep longer. But if you want to extend that life, it's good to put things like greens in a sealed plastic bag with a little piece of damp paper towel in there that will keep your greens fresh for a long time, or keeping food in the crisper. I also have some friends, if you're not going to use your foods right away, a really good idea is to go ahead and prep them. So say you got so much Swiss chard or so much kale, you're like, I'm not going to use this week. You can chop that up, put it in a bag in the freezer, ready to go, so that over the next several weeks, you just take a handful at a time, throw it in your soup, throw it in your stir fry, which I find also encourages people to use that food because it's less time in prepping it. Sometimes if you'd be discouraged if you have to chop kale every time and you'll just eat a Hot Pocket or whatever. But if you have it kind of pre-washed and pre-sliced, more likely to use it.
Are things changing, Leah? Is it actually changing out here? I know you are probably on the front lines and you're looking to change things, but are things actually changing? Are you seeing more people of color, more Blacks, more Latinos getting into farming? And if so, what are some of the challenges that they're still facing?
You know, I think things really are changing. We're referring to ourselves as that returning generation. So, you know, our grandparents, our great grandparents are the ones who fled the red clays of Georgia, seeking those paved streets of the urban north and not looking back because they didn't want to stoop or sweat or get dirty and imagine that would revert them to bondage. But, you know, now we realize we left something behind in those red clays. We left some culture. We left some access to good, healthy food. We left some sense of dignity and power in terms of providing for ourselves and our communities. And this generation is woke around those issues and really excited to garden, to farm, to, you know, get engaged with healthy food. And so I am seeing a clamor. I mean, I can't even tell you. Soulfire is just one of these farms and we get hundreds of requests every day for engagement, whether that's teaching, talking, so forth. So I'm very motivated and excited. You know, in the last census, for the first time in 100 years, there was a very slight uptick in the number of Black farmers in this country. Yeah. For the first time in 100 years. And so we're going to keep that trend going.
Yeah, I hope that things are changing because I see a trend where, like I said, people are disconnected from their food. I remember when I was a kid, we used to always sing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. And now I don't think kids are saying that. I don't think kids even know where their food comes from. A lot of them just think that, hey, you go to the grocery store and that's where the food actually come from. My last question for you is, you talked about plants. There's so much good information in your book. I can't cover it all in an hour, but one of the things, my mother passed in 2005, and I remember receiving a lot. Thank you. I remember receiving a lot of her stuff, and I remember I still have one of her books that she had, and her book was around herbs and different plants for medicinal purposes. And you mentioned that in the book. And I feel that I, like you, I just found out I'm kind of a multicultural person. I didn't even know until I took my 23andMe results, and I'm figuring out that I'm so many hodgepodge of different things, not just African, but a lot of other things. But I always noticed that even as a kid, African Americans seem to have this disposition or this affinity towards herbs and plants and using those different things. And like I said, my mom, I got one of her old books, and I saw where she was writing down different things before she passed from cancer, or things that she wanted to use to try to fix her ailments. But is that a part of your farm? Do you do any growing those plants or those different types of medicinal plants to help people?
Oh, you definitely do. So I will tell you about this one beautiful child, this teenager named Librado, who came to the farm, and he was telling me how he has trouble sleeping at night. He worries a lot. And so I took him down to, we have a beautiful herb, many herb gardens, but this one that's intermixed with the orchards. And I started picking him some lemon balm, some chamomile, some, you know, anti-anxiety herbs, things to help with sleep, and made him this bundle and was telling him how he can make tea at night before he goes to sleep and so forth. And this child was clutching these herbs to his chest, like the most precious, like treasure, you know, that I made special for him. And to see that look on his face and these other young people being like, wait, you can grow your medicine? Like, you don't have to go to the doctor for little things, and you can just come outside and pick it, and then you can sleep, or help you deal with your asthma, or, you know, all these issues, your colds. They were astounded. And so that's been a very, very important part of not just our health and well-being, but also the kind of message we pass on to the next generation, in terms of you can be in charge of your well-being. It's not just up to these external factors that are influencing you.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that we've become really disconnected from the land, and everything has been shifted towards medicine, to pharmaceuticals and drugs. And we've forgotten that we never had any of this stuff before. So we had to basically rely on plants and different types of things. I remember my grandmother would always, anything we had, it was always turpentine. Use turpentine. And we've forgotten all these things, and we would do it, and we would have good results with it. So it's crazy how we've gotten away from that. But Leah, your book is called Farming While Black. Like I said, a lot of great information in there for those people who are looking towards going to farming as a career, but also a lot of information that people may not know, because I didn't know a lot about chickens and how chickens were slaughtered and all the other information that's in there. But your book is located on, I would imagine, Amazon. That's where I got in all the other book outlets. But if people want to get in contact with you, do you have a website?
Absolutely. We would love for folks to get in touch at soulfirefarm.org. And our social media handle is also soulfirefarm, all one word.
Leah Pinham, thank you for being a Perfectly Healthy Time Radio.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.